So tonight I wanted to talk about one of the recitations that we did. This is our continuing series of talks about the liturgy. So this one is on the Song of the Grassroot Hermitage. And it's by, I'll make a stab at this, Shitu Zichang. We only have two pieces of writing by Shitu. And they're the two recitations that we did. It's all that has been left. But they're two wonderful pieces, and so I'm really glad that they're part of our liturgy. Shitu lived, I wrote this down out of Wikipedia, from 700 to 790, was one of the founders of the Soto line of Zen. And he studied under Huineng, who is one of our one of the six great ancestors in China. And Dongshan, who is a very important teacher in the Zen lineage, was one of his descendants, his Dharma descendants. So Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. I particularly like that the hut is made out of, has a grass roof. I mean, I suppose they all did back then. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe they had tile or something like that. But the image for me of a grass roof, it brings to mind the ox herding pictures. Are you familiar with them? It's a series of 10 pictures. They're all in it. Each one is in a circle. They're often seen. We have a set of them at the Greater Boston Zen Center on scrolls, 10 scrolls. And it's supposed to depict the process, I guess you could say, the life of Zen practice. And the first one is a boy searching for the ox. The ox is his Buddha nature, his mind. He's searching for it through these tall grasses. You just see him, you know, there's nothing there that you can see except for grass, and he's parting them, looking and looking. And I think about this grass roof hermitage being built from these grasses that this is a common way in Zen of referring to the world of delusion. All this stuff that grows up in front of you, you can't see, you know, clearly. This hermitage is built from the world of delusion. It reminded me of a quote by Dogen. So I wrote it down, I'll read it. When we realize the way, we do not realize with something else. We realize only with sounds and colors. When we are deluded, we are not deluded with something else. We are deluded only with sounds and colors. A deluded person and an enlightened person at the same time use one boat, and each is not obstructed. So there's not some other world where we can practice. We make up our lives out of this world of delusion, and we're not obstructed. The poem begins, I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. A strange thing to say, nothing of value. From an absolute point of view, all things are the same. There's no one thing that you can hold up that's worth more than anything else. All come from the same source. And all are of the nature of impermanence, all empty. I don't think he means so much that we don't have a value for anything. You know, there are things that we value. But ultimately, all of the same value, this no value. Bodhidharma, there's a famous dialogue. This is another one of the great ancestors, Bodhidharma, who brought Zen from India to China. He had a dialogue with the emperor in China when he came back. And the emperor asked him, you know, I I've heard that you're, you know, a great Zen master. Tell me, what is the highest holy principle in Zen? And Bodhidharma answered, vast emptiness, nothing holy. And so this nothing of value, nothing holy, just what is. So I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. And so this whole grass hut image, I've heard different people talk about it in different ways, and so I suppose there is no one right way that it's meant to be. For me, the image of the grass hut that's being built here is an entire life, how we live our life. Some people see it as this process of Zazen, this practice. Some see it as the construction that we make of ourselves in our minds. So however it comes to you, you know, go with it. My point of view for this talk is that it's about our life of practice. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. This is quite unusual to hear in a Zen poem. Usually we're being encouraged to work hard, to pay attention, and that there's some effort that needs to be made. And he's saying, I eat, I relax, I enjoy a nap. No need to be terribly ascetic here. We don't need to deny ourselves. That's not something that makes it automatically sacred if we feel pain. And this is a common misconception, and it probably was in his day as well. I remember when I first became interested in Buddhism, I was 16. And for my 16th birthday, I asked my parents to send to the Vedanta Society, which was the only connection I knew of to Buddhism. They were in California, and I asked my parents to send for some books on Buddhism from there. And to celebrate my 16th birthday, I decided that I was going to fast for 3 days. My family was not behind this, but there wasn't a whole lot that they could do. But there's this sort of popular misconception that the spiritual life involves these ascetic practices. And she too is saying, after eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. And it doesn't have to be that way. But when it was completed, fresh weeds appeared, the hut he means. And now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. So these are those weeds, those grasses of delusion. He said, when it was completed, when he had reached this point, fresh weeds appeared. So he had cleared out all the delusion. It was all clear to him. And then more weeds came up. So really, it's never complete. We are never finished with this practice. More delusions come up. In our closing chant, we say, delusions are endless. Huh, I forget how it goes.
I
vow to end them, right. So that dichotomy, we make this impossible vow, right, to end them, and yet they never end. And so he's saying the same thing. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. And now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The weeds aren't a problem. Of course it's the world of delusion, as Dogen said. Same boat, enlightened person or ordinary person. This is the world that we live in, and it's not a problem. Let the weeds grow. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. This is, to me, a reference, this being not stuck, is similar to the beginning of one of our chants. The first line is, the great way is not difficult if you are not attached to preferences, or variously translated, if you just don't pick and choose. But I think there's nothing wrong with picking and choosing. Of course, we have our opinions, we have our preferences. She too is saying, just don't be stuck to them. Don't insist on them. I don't know if you have seen the movie When Harry Met Sally, but Sally was quite a piece of work. And she definitely had her preferences. So when she would go into a restaurant, her order, it would take a while to say it all because, well, she would want, you know, the bread toasted, and it would have to be the bread with the sesame seeds on top. And she wanted the cheeseburger, but don't melt the cheese onto the burger, and you know, just add it on top at the end. And she definitely wanted mustard, but only the French grainy kind, not that, you know, the other. And she wanted the pickle on the side, don't put it in, you know, and on. I mean, she was a real pain in the ass, right? Because she was stuck to her preferences. It had to be this way, very inflexible. So it's not a very calm way to live, I would say. And she too is saying the person in the hut here lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Not stuck to anything, anywhere. It all moves freely. When we sit with our eyes partly open, inside and outside, can move back and forth. And it's hard to tell really where is the delineation between one and the other. You know, does the seeing take place out where the thing is? Does it take place back here where our retinas, you know, meet up with the nervous system? It's this free interplay back and forth, not stuck anywhere. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. And so it's not that there's something wrong with these worldly places and realms, but just that perhaps they've lost the value that they once had in terms of must have this, desiring this, need these things, the status, the goods, material things. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In just this place, an old man illumines forms and their nature. So we've talked about, usually in orientation, I'll say something about how when we sit down on this cushion, this tiny little square, we bring our whole life with us. It plays out right here in this little space. The hut is small, but it includes the entire world. There's a book that it's a book of a translation of Dogen's writings. He has a lot of writings in comparison to Shi Tu. He's got several thick books full. But one of them is called Moon in a Dewdrop. And this is an image that's often used in Zen to the moon is enlightenment. It's the metaphor for enlightenment and wholeness. It's round, bright. But every dewdrop completely reflects the whole moon. Each one has the full moon reflected in it, not lacking anything, fully expressing enlightenment, fully expressing true nature. And so the hut is small and includes the entire world. Even a dewdrop holds that entire world. And in just this place, an old man illumines forms and then their nature. Only requires this much space, just this body, to illumine all of nature. A Mahayana bodhisattva trusts without doubt. Well, I would say maybe eventually. And I think that doubt is useful. I'm not sure quite which kind of doubt he's talking about here. We have the kind of doubt that is considered to be one of the three pillars of Zen. The three pillars are faith, doubt, and determination. Those three standing like a stool, giving our practice stability. Sometimes one stronger than the other moves around. Necessary to have some doubt, some questioning. What is this? What is this about? Why are things the way they are? Why do I feel this sense of lack or you know, whatever it is that drives us to do this practice? But he says he trusts without doubt. This is the faith aspect, really, where no matter what the questions are that come forward, no matter what he's presented with, he feels this great faith that carries him through. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? He's asking, do we die? What happens? What happens after death? And he says, the middly or lowly can't help wondering this. But who else is there? But the middling and lowly, who hasn't asked this? Everyone does. And so he goes on, perishable or not, the original master is present. The original master, who is this? Who is it who doesn't concern himself with alive or dead, what comes next? The original master is the one right here, right now, experiencing this moment, participating in it. What point to ask about after death? There's this, all of this, right now. Not dwelling south or north, east or west, this original master. Not found out there somewhere. Don't have to go south or north, east or west to find it. It's like saying, where are my eyes? Where are my eyes? I can't see my eyes. I can't see them because they are you. They are part of your face. And so going out somewhere searching for the original master, for this original nature, is aimed in the wrong direction. Already here, already fully expressing it. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. This steadiness that we chant about, the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. This is the steadiness that he refers to. Can't be surpassed. I think that's part of our chant too, the closing chant. Buddha nature is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. He's saying even his humble hut, nothing could be better than this. Everything he needs is right there. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. And this is the rest of a sort of inner stillness, I suppose. We don't need to just confine it to inner, because when we're still within, all things become still. Even when we're walking, that stillness is there. Even when we're in the midst of the marketplace, or the workplace, nevertheless, we bring this forth. All things are at rest. And thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. There was a talk earlier, it's one of the first ones, about not knowing is most intimate. Thank you for that. It's a story, or a koan, which is a sort of story of a dialogue that happened long ago between a monk and a teacher. And the monk has been on pilgrimage, and he comes to a monastery and meets the teacher to sit with him and learn from him as part of his pilgrimage. And the teacher asks him, where did you come from? And he says, where? And he says, why are you doing this pilgrimage? And where are you going? And the monk says, I don't know. And the teacher says, not knowing is most intimate. It's a wonderful state of mind to have when we wonder. We haven't already decided where we are. We're looking around. We're discovering it moment by moment. And so he says, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. He isn't presuming anything. He isn't aimed toward anything. Just living his life right this moment, fully. Living here, she no longer works to get free. And it does sometimes feel like work. often feels like work. You know, we sit here and work against our bodies, which want to get up and move, our minds, which don't want to be, would prefer to be distracted. There's this effort. And he's suggesting that, well, he says she, or the, at least the translation is that, she no longer works to get free. There comes a point, this would be perhaps one of those Oxfording pictures further along, where the boy is riding on top of the ox, playing a flute, carefree, maybe bluebirds flying around or something. And this is not, this poem and these Oxfording pictures are not something static, like when you get to the 10th picture, then all is well forever. They're more of a sort of spiral. You come back and visit them all over and over again, but from a slightly different angle each time. And so when he says, no longer works to get free, maybe true today, maybe not so much tomorrow. Not stuck anywhere. And then this line, who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? So a curious one, and the only sense that I can make out of it is that perhaps at that time, as now, some teachers would try to entice people to come to the to their monastery or to hear their teachings by offering little special somethings. How do I want to say this? Enticing them, as if the teaching itself was not enough. Come here and we'll, you know, have tea and cookies afterwards every time. Or we have a more ornate temple. It's wonderful. Much better to sit here. This sort of thing. Who would need to do that? Turn around the light to shine within, and then just return. This is the basic instruction, isn't it? We sit and turn this light inward and return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. And here again, searching for our own face, you can't turn away from it, you can't face it. Because you are it, this vast, inconceivable source. Already, this is our birthright. This is our nature. Even though it's in us to seek it, and we have to make that effort, nevertheless, we eventually turn and come home, because that's where we have always been, where this vast, inconceivable source has always been. Meet the ancestral teachers. Be familiar with their instruction. Bind grasses to build a hut. And don't give up. I like how he adds the don't give up. It's a nod to the fact that we can't always just be enjoying life and taking a nap. That it takes effort. It takes effort to get there. And so he's encouraging, don't give up. It really is worth doing. Yes, it does take hard work. Of course, but bind those grasses and to build the hut. Don't be lost in them. Keep searching. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. I like that. It often feels like, you know, at the end of a long day of work, it feels like we're carrying hundreds of years on our backs. All the burdens, all the past following us around, dragging along behind us, whatever. And yet, all of that in our minds, you know, those hundreds of years are gone. There's never hundreds of years. There's only ever one moment. And so if that were true, if we could drop all that away, would we not relax completely? I think so. Open your hands and walk innocent. Such a different image than don't give up. It's sort of at the other side of it. Open your hands, walk innocent. I came upon a poem by Dogen that sort of reflects this, so I thought I would read it. Just popped up this week. Realization, neither general nor particular, is effort without desire. So he acknowledges effort is made, but it's not made toward anything. We aren't attached to a result, just effort without desire. Clear water all the way to the bottom. A fish swims like a fish. Vast sky, transparent throughout. A bird flies like a bird. To me, that sounds like open your hands and walk, innocent. Just fly if you're a bird. Just swim if you're a fish. It's clear water all the way down. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations are only to free you from instructions. It's curious that the works of Zen are a burgeoning library. I mean, there are so many books being written about Zen, about this practice where we're supposed to go beyond words, beyond thoughts and letters. And yet there's so much to be said about it. But they are only to free you from obstructions. And if you don't need them anymore, open your hands and walk away, innocent. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. So he brings us right back around to the world of the grasses, the delusion. It's not something that has to be transcended. It's not that we have to get past our this world of body and things and colors and sounds. This is what we use to study what our lives are. This is how we find our way back. Don't separate from this skin bag here and now. Truly be it. Stand fully in your own footsteps and manifest your own life completely. Thank you.